to welcome this morning our guests from West Allis Central High School and Wisconsin Heights High School. They're here with our national award-winning program called Court for the Facts. And the students have been given summaries of the case and have discussed it in class. And we want to welcome them and hope that they enjoy this experience. So would we have the West Allis Central High School students please stand? Thank you. You may be seated. And would the Wisconsin Heights High School please stand? Welcome to you also, and please be seated. Now that you have been introduced, I would like to introduce the court to you. On my far left is Justice David Prosser, and to his right, Justice Ann Walsh Bradley, and to my immediate left, Justice William Babbage. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my right is Justice Donald Steinmetz, and to his right, Justice John Wilcox. And on the far right is Justice Patrick Brooks. And with these introductions made, I would just also remind you that at noon, you will, or whenever this case is completed, you will meet with Justice Donald Steinmetz here, and you will be joined by the Sun Prairie High School students and discuss the court procedures. Anyone else who wishes to be here for that discussion is welcome. I'm now ready to call the second case for this morning, which is Jay Smith versus Paul Katz, and we'll first hear from Mr. Tessmatner.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, I am Kent Tessmatner of the Milwaukee area law firm of Schmidt & Ruppke SC. I represent the petitioner, Philip Jufri, who is also present with me in court today. At the outset, my client, I would like to express our gratitude at being before you again on this case. As you know, we were before you in April of last year and argued the merits of this insurance coverage appeal. You noted in your June 2nd decision that the insurance policy in the record at that time did not cover the time period in which the damage is alleged to have occurred. You remanded to the trial court with directions that it determine if West Penn Mutual Insurance Company had in fact issued a policy which applied to the time period in which the damage in this case allegedly occurred. On behalf of Mr. Jufri, we ask the court to amend the record to include the applicable policy and to reconsider its remand. This court did both, and we are grateful for that. At the outset of this second round, the court should note that West Bend Mutual Insurance Company does not dispute that the policy form now in the record is identical to the one before the court in April as far as the relevant provisions are concerned. Therefore, you will hear from both sides much of the same argument today as you did in April, I'm afraid, and the reconsideration letters reflect this. This review really raises only one question, although there are, as with most questions, several issues. Whether West Bend Mutual Insurance Company has a duty to defend and indemnify Philip Jufri against the claims made against him by Jane Deborah Smith. It involves application of a standard form comprehensive general liability insurance policy to the amended complaint of the Smiths. It is our position, and the position, again, it was succinctly stated by the Court of Appeals, that the complaint specifically alleges that misrepresentations attributed to Mr. Jufri caused the damages. It is our position that the complaint can be read to state that the misrepresentations caused property damage covered by the policy, and it's our further position that the alienated premises exclusion in this comprehensive general liability policy does not apply to the facts of this case. The Court of Appeals stated that absent the alienated premises exclusion, it would agree that the pleadings in this case trigger a duty to defend. although we realize that the question of whether an insurance company has a duty to defend is a matter, is a question of law, we believe that this court's de novo review will show that there is coverage. As this court knows, if there's any doubt as to coverage, it is to be resolved in favor of the insured. This case arises out of the sale by Mr. Jufrey to the Smiths of a vacant residential lot located in the city of Franklin, which is located in Milwaukee County. The Smiths initially filed a four-claim complaint against Mr. Jufrey alone. They later amended their complaint to add their builder and the consulting engineer used by the builder. The allegations against Mr. Jufrey, however, are identical in both sets of pleadings. In this case, the lot that Mr. Jufrey sold to the Smiths slopes upward away from the street. Over 2 years after Mr. Jufrey sold the house to the Smiths, the builder first decided to begin building. When he dug into the hillside, he opened up the shallow water table on the lot. He built the house into the side of the hill and into the water table after consulting with the engineer that he called in. The Smiths are complaining that groundwater pressure has caused cracking inside the house, basement floor cracking, and shifting of their basement wall. Their expert engineer has given the opinion that the foundation wall has been pushed in 7/16 of an inch and has been cracked. Their expert hydrogeologist has given the opinion that the groundwater pressure is causing this and that a trench should be cut uphill from this house to capture and collect the water and direct it around the sides of the house to the front of the street where the storm sewer is located. Other experts have given opinions in this case that it will cost anywhere from $11,000 to $20,000 to repair the damage to this rear foundation wall. The Court of Appeals held, and West Bend argues today, that the alienated premises exclusion in the comprehensive general liability policy applies to exclude coverage. That exclusion states that the insurance does not apply to property damage to premises you sell, give away, or abandon if the property damage arises out of any part of those premises. The exclusion does not apply in this case because the premises that Mr. Jufrey sold have not suffered any property damage at all. All that Mr. Jufrey sold to the Smiths was a vacant lot. There are no allegations that the lot itself has been damaged. The Smiths' expert hydrogeologist testified unequivocally that there has been no failure of the hillside due to the high water table in it or as a result of the builder digging into it. Instead, what the Smiths are seeking as an element of their damages is the cost to correct the damage to the house that they placed into the hill 2 years after the sale. Mr. Jufrey did not sell the house to the Smiths. Therefore, as to this element of damages, the Smiths are not claiming damage to anything that Mr. Jufrey sold to them. Because of this, the alienated premises exclusion does not apply to this damage claim, and West Bend Mutual has a duty to defend. The trial court and West Bend Mutual in its briefs based their entire position on the black letter rule of property, that a house or the foundation of a house built onto land beneath them become premises. They fit within that legal category of premises. They concede in their briefs that the Smiths do claim property damage to these later built improvements, but argue by becoming premises, the house somehow becomes premises sold by Mr. Jufrey. This analysis skips the last step which has to be taken in applying the exclusion. It is whether Mr. Jufrey sold the premises that are damaged. He did not sell the house. An illustration or two shows why it makes no sense to stop the analysis where West Bend Mutual stops. We all know that another black letter rule is that a fixture becomes part of premises once installed. If we apply West Bend Mutual's position, if a builder builds a new home with no dining room light fixture, and the home buyer 2 years after the purchase of the home installs a chandelier which is defective, the homeowner has a claim against the builder if the builder warrants against defects in the premises. Although there's no Wisconsin case directly on point on this alienated premises exclusion, as this court knows, I did find and I did cite to the court and indeed put in my appendix insurance industry publications, which are on point and came out when the comprehensive general liability policy was promulgated in its current form. I also found out cases from other jurisdictions which support our position on this exclusion. One of the articles I cited was the Malecki and Flitner article. It was published by the National Underwriters Company on this exclusion when it was promulgated in the form that's now in the West Bend policy before you. This article makes it clear that the alienated premises exclusion does not apply to damage to property other than the alienated premises.
Well, and the cases you they cite, the property is certainly distinct. The property damages are very distinct from the property that was sold. Here, you've got a building, and I agree it's distinct from the land. But the whole issue involves that it's the land that's defective, in quotes, right?
Right.
And the land is what was alienated, was sold.
Correct.
And it's this land that's theoretically causing the damage. Or maybe you think it's the misrepresentation that's causing the damage.
I think it's both, actually.
It's both?
Yes.
Okay.
The position and I set that forth in my letter reply brief, I think it's both. As far as the misrepresentation, you know, and my point there is that I only have to...
Want to find out, on the misrepresentation, was it that you could build anything on this lot? What was the misrepresentation was that it was, you could have built a building if you had not put a basement in? Or could you, by building into the hillside, your client was aware of the water table. Once they began to dig, they became aware, and then they proceeded to go ahead.
My client was never aware of the water table until this lawsuit was filed after the house had been built. My client, there's nothing in the record that shows he was ever aware of it whatsoever.
The builders were not aware. No one was aware of it.
The builders had to be aware.
That's
of
right.
It.
You have the suit against the builder, too.
Right. And I represent petitioner before you is the seller of the land, not the builder.
But the misrepresentation basically was what?
Well, if you read the complaint, they do not plead an active misrepresentation. They're arguing misrepresentation by omission. Their theory in this case is that Mr. Giuffre knew about the fact that there was a high water table on this lot and didn't tell anybody about it. So it's not an active misrepresentation. It's misrepresentation by omission.
Correct.
And getting back to the question that I think the Chief Justice was posing, yes, you're correct. The cases that I've cited, including the Reeder versus Cherokee Insurance Company case, do deal with personal injury claims as distinct from property damage. They do deal with tangible property items as distinct from property damage. But they also all underscore that the defects in the building or the damage to the building pre-existed, or they also underscore that they're seeking compensation for damage to something that was actually sold by the seller, who is the insured. In this case, the damages are to a house that didn't exist until 2 years after the closing took place where Mr. Giuffre sold the property. As I have argued before, and I believe I argued in my briefs, the Reeder versus Cherokee Insurance Company case is helpful by analogy. There the insured sold an existing apartment complex, the building caught fire, and the buyer sued for damage to the buildings, and the tenants sued for their personal injury and for their damage to tangible property. The court applied the alienated premises exclusion to the claims for damage to the buildings because the seller had sold them to the buyer. We don't have that in this case. The damage complained of is to a foundation that wasn't built until 2 years later. The groundwater pollution cases I cited, I think, also are helpful by analogy. Those would be the Reliance Insurance Company versus Armstrong case, and the F.L. Smith versus Travelers Insurance Company case. Those are both 1996 cases out of New Jersey. In those cases, they did analyze whether this alienated premises exclusion had any application. Those cases hold at the outset that although groundwater is clearly in the ground and part of the premises at the time that you sell a lot, it cannot be premises you sell when you sell a lot because the lot owner does not own or have title to the groundwater. Therefore, in cases where a buyer of a lot alleges that groundwater is contaminated because of pollutants stored on or in the soil of the land sold, the alienated premises exclusion does not preclude coverage because the seller never owned the groundwater and could not have sold it. The New Jersey case in Reliance Insurance Company said since the insured did not own the groundwater, it was not part of the premises alienated by the insured. In this case, Mr. Giuffre never owned the house built on the lot. It was built 2 years after the sale, and it cannot be part of the premises he sold any more than the groundwater could be part of premises sold by the seller in New Jersey. The other analysis that West Bend brings up is that there's not coverage in the first place, and it is our position that there is, even though the Court of Appeals hung its decision totally on the alienated premises exclusion. I recognize that this is a de novo review, but the Court of Appeals did state that but for the alienated premises exclusion, it would have found that there was coverage, and we believe that that latter analysis is correct. The comprehensive general liability policy that was issued to Mr. Giuffre has a broad grant of coverage at page 1 of the policy. It says we will pay those sums that the insured becomes legally obligated to pay as damages because of bodily injury or property damage to which this insurance applies. We will have the right and duty to defend any suit seeking those damages. The policy then goes on to provide that it applies to bodily injury or property damage only if the bodily injury or property damage are caused by an occurrence. Occurrence is defined in this standard form policy as an accident, including continuous or repeated exposure to substantially the same general harmful conditions.
What's the accident?
The accident in this case would be the misrepresentations not being done intentionally. As courts knows, I've cited the Sheets versus Brethren Insurance case to it, I believe from Maryland, that surveyed all of the law in existence at the time in the country about whether a misrepresentation can be an occurrence. And they concluded with the majority of the cases that they cited that a misrepresentation can be an innocent misrepresentation. If so, it is an accident and it's an occurrence.
Did you allege negligent misrepresentation or intentional misrepresentation in your complaint?
The Smiths alleged three species of misrepresentation. It's the standard complaint that you see where they allege intentional, they allege strict responsibility for misrepresentation, and they also allege negligent misrepresentation. So all three species are alleged in this complaint.
But intentional is out. Do you agree with that?
I agree intentional is out as far as indemnity. I contend that it's in as far as defend because, as the court knows, if you have to defend as to anything, you've got to defend as to all of it. But yes. We're not seeking, we're not arguing the intentional acts exclusion doesn't apply as far as indemnity.
So you're arguing that the negligent misrepresentation is an occurrence because it is an accident, a negligent misrepresentation. Is that your argument?
That would be one of my arguments, yes. I also would argue that under strict responsibility, which does not require any scienter on the part of the person making the misrepresentation at all, it simply requires a finding later on that that representation was wrong, that it also would apply to that as well. Both of those would be accidents. Occurrence in this case also is defined as including continuous or repeated exposure to the substantially the same general harmful conditions. That applies to the water. As I told the Chief Justice, it's our position that either the misrepresentation or the groundwater can be the occurrence. I don't have to prove both. Either one of them triggers a duty to defend and triggers a duty to indemnify.
Could I ask, sir, how long did Mr. Giuffre own this property?
Yeah, I don't recall the exact amount of time that he owned it. He did get it on a like-kind exchange for a multifamily apartment building, and he simply kept it in inventory because he is a builder, and he thought that he could build on it sometime, but he always had it up for sale. I think the period of time he owned it was, and I'm just speculating here, and I don't know what the record reflects, approximately 3 to 5 years is my recollection.
Did he have any other contiguous property or property in the immediate area?
Yes, there were two lots, I believe. No, there were three lots, one on either side of this lot. I want to focus on the elements of why we think there is coverage here. We believe this amended complaint can and should be read as alleging property damage caused by an occurrence.
Where do you allege property damage?
Paragraphs 17, 23, and 27 of the amended complaint, the Smiths allege they have suffered damages. They don't allege what kind of damages they have suffered, what was damaged, or what measure of damages they invoke. Our position is that the use of the word damages without modification is sufficiently broad to encompass the concept of property damage. And I cited to the court this court's decision on reconsideration in School District of Charlotte versus Wausau Insurance Company to back that up. In that decision, this court looked at Black's Law Dictionary for the accepted technical meaning in law of the word damages, unmodified, just the word damages. And that definition, as cited by this court, was a pecuniary compensation or indemnity which may be recovered in the courts by any person who has suffered loss, detriment, or injury, whether to his person, property, or rights, through the unlawful act or omission or negligence of another. This definition clearly encompasses property damage, and the policy mirrors that. The policy says physical injury to tangible property or property damage.
Now, under your allegation of intentional misrepresentation, you talk about in 15 pecuniary damages.
Yeah, the word pecuniary damages does appear once in the complaint. The word damages without pecuniary appears three times. Our position is that the one-time use of the word pecuniary damages does not remove this from the argument of property damage.
Pecuniary, what's the difference between property damage and pecuniary damage in this case?
It depends on which of your cases we read. There are the Black's Law Dictionary, which is quoted by this court in the school district case, says that damages means a pecuniary compensation. That to me means it's just something that can be measured by money. It doesn't necessarily mean it's economic loss only. In this particular case, we have the plaintiffs stating that, among other things, they're looking for the cost of repair for repairing their damaged foundation wall. And we have in the record that that's going to cost the minimum of $11,000 and perhaps as much as $20,000. This is property damage. And the complaint, using the term damages, is broad enough to...
What are your damages? I mean, you say repair or the trench. What else are your damages?
You mean the plaintiff's damages?
Right.
Yeah. I hope my client's damages
right,
are nothing.
Right. I meant the plaintiff's damages.
The plaintiffs are seeking, as they've detailed through discovery, and they've both been deposed and they've answered multiple sets of interrogatories, not just from me but from other counsel. They are seeking a variety of things. They are seeking the cost of repairing their basement wall. They are seeking the cost of putting in this trench uphill from the house to capture the water and putting into that trench a drainage tile system that will take that around to the front of the house, and conveniently located right in front of this house is a municipal storm sewer that they can hook up to. So they're seeking that expense. They also have answered in interrogatories that they will believe that they have suffered a diminishment in value because they got the city of Greenfield to lower their assessment by bringing the city assessor out and showing him these problems. That raises the whole economic loss issue. I would simply point out that we have property damage, we have economic loss. The lowering of the assessment lowers the value as to not only the land, but also as to the improvements on it. But those are what they have specified as what their itemization of damages would be. The other thing I would point out, and it kind of fits in with this, is that the Gildenvan versus Schrader decision of this court indicates that there are consequential damages allowed in any misrepresentation case, and these damages that we're talking about clearly fit into that. Other item that we believe is met here is that there is a causal link in this case between the misrepresentations made and the property damage suffered, and that has to be proven for coverage as well. The amended complaint alleges that the property damage was caused by Mr. Jufri's alleged misrepresentations by omission of the existence of underground water. West Bend argues that misrepresentations cannot cause damage to other property to occur. In this case, not only can the complaint be construed as alleging just that, but that is what happened. There's ample evidence in this case that if Mr. Jufri had told the Smiths about a high water table, assuming he knew it, before they engaged the builder, they could have taken steps to be sure that any house constructed on it would not suffer property damage. Their expert engineer that they brought in after the litigation was started testified that the rear wall should have been designed as a retaining wall because it was going into the side of a hill, and it was not. Their expert hydrologist testified that a drainage trench needed to be built uphill from the house, and this was not done either. Because none of this happened, and our argument is that it would have been or could have been considered had this water table problem been disclosed, the Smith's house now has been damaged by the groundwater. Thanks. My time is up.
Thank you, counsel. You have 5 minutes for a rebuttal. Representing West Bend Mutual Insurance Company, Mr. Beck.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. I'm Jeff Level, and I do represent West Bend Mutual Insurance Company. It'll take me just a quick second to get my documents. I'd like to begin by observing something that may not be apparent from a first glance in this complaint. As an oral arguer before you, I struggle in preparing to figure out something I could say that would be novel and wouldn't try your patience with a reiteration of the briefs. And I think I hit upon it last night as I reread the complaint in this matter. And in representing the insurance company in this action, I look to the complaint as the touchstone, because as this court has said many times over, it's the allegations of the complaint that the insurer must look to in deciding whether it has to defend an insured in a lawsuit. And I think that's important because insurers don't defend every lawsuit brought against their policyholder. They do when they are allegations in the lawsuit that are within the terms of the policy. And I looked at the complaint, and particularly the amended complaint, because it has 7 counts. 4 of them against the policyholder here, Mr. Jaffrey, and then 3 of them against the home builder and the engineer. And what's very interesting about the complaint in this action is that all of the allegations against the policyholder in claims 1 through 4 concern events that happened in 1991. That makes sense because the closing of this real estate transaction occurred in 1991. We know from the record here, and it's undisputed, that the building itself and the alleged crack in the wall that occurred in the 7/16 of an inch bowl didn't happen until sometime after 1993.
Now, you're not going to say that we have the wrong policy here.
Well, in the sense that I don't think any of the policies cover this lawsuit, yes, I am.
When you start getting into dates, it makes me nervous.
Well, hopefully I can allay your fears. My reference to dates is just this. that what happened in 1993 and thereafter, and particularly the alleged crack in the foundation wall, are the subject of allegations against the home builder and the engineer, not Mr. Jaffrey. And that's a real important thing. I hope the court agrees that the insurance company had to consider when reviewing this complaint. Because what's alleged against Mr. Jaffrey, the policyholder, is misrepresentation that damaged the buyer in 1991 when the transaction occurred. Because just like the home or property buyers in the Court of Appeals, Qualman and Benjamin decisions, the damage accrued here, as alleged in 1993, at least by the allegations of the complaint. And moving beyond the dates that are referenced in counts 1 through 4, and then the 2 year later dates referenced in counts 5 through 7, if you go to what I always call the ad damnum clause, I'm never quite sure what that meant, but at the end of the complaint is the prayer for relief. And the plaintiff didn't allege joint and several liability against Mr. Jaffrey or the home builder and the engineer. The complaint's prayer for relief expressly requests judgment against Mr. Jaffrey on counts 1 through 4 and judgment against the homeowner or the home builder and the engineer on counts 5 through 7, but not jointly and severally.
So, what's your conclusion from all that?
My conclusion, Your Honor, is that what's alleged against Mr. Jaffrey is not property damage because it's not physical injury to tangible property or loss of use. It's a misrepresentation damage, a pecuniary damage, the pocketbook injury that occurred when the transaction closed in 1991.
So, he buys raw land in 1991. That raw land, unbeknownst to the purchaser, has a water problem, right?
That's the allegation. This property is less than 2 blocks from the Root River, which most of the school children in this room will know, perhaps, because of its location in Milwaukee. But yes, that's the allegation, that they were unaware of the water.
Okay. And your position then is that's the time of the damage?
Correct. The alleged damage.
Okay. And that the alleged damage is the difference between the value of the property with a water problem, alleged water problem, without an alleged water problem. Is that the point?
Correct.
All right. And then what do you do with that?
Well, then you look to the terms of the policy.
Right.
And I appreciate that both the Circuit Court and the Court of Appeals went to the exclusion of render the decision.
Right.
But I think the decision is more clearly under the insuring agreement. You never get to an exclusion if you don't have an insurance coverage set forth in the insuring agreement.
All right. What's your principal point about why there's not coverage? Is it that it's not property damage, that it's not an occurrence?
There is no occurrence causing property damage, and that's what the insuring agreement requires. And I think, frankly, that's why appellant's arguments in this case about what's the occurrence and what's the damage are so confused. And I don't say that to be mean-spirited. I think it's an important observation. Is the occurrence the so-called alleged misrepresentation? Or is it, as we heard in oral argument, the existence of groundwater? And the problem here is that if you buy that property damage, in this case, as relates to Jaffrey and West Bend Mutual, is the crack in the foundation wall, you can't call the occurrence the misrepresentation, because the misrepresentation didn't cause the crack in the wall. The misrepresentation caused the buyer to buy property that it believes it will cost more to make suitable for putting a residence on it because of drainage problems. What caused the crack in the foundation, so says plaintiff's expert, is the groundwater. And that's why the policyholder in this case is arguing to you both that the occurrence is the misrepresentation, an oral statement, or in this case a failure to make one, and the groundwater.
What about this, that the misrepresentation by omission caused the plaintiff, and this is what your opposing counsel argued, caused the plaintiff to position the house in the lot in a different area than it would have, or maybe put drain tile in. Without that information of the underwater table, you know, and I'm just asking questions. Without that information, they built the house differently than they would have had they had the information, either by way of location or putting a different drain tile.
That might have been alleged, but that wasn't alleged. And again, I return to the four corners. The complaint has to make the allegation. And I think sort of a tangential observation here. We hear a lot of argument from appellants about the deposition testimony establishing the crack, the interrogatories establishing this. But to make your decision on that basis, you have to depart from the long-accepted four corners rule. You'd have to look at the discovery to find a duty to defend here.
Well, I look at page 128 of the appendix, paragraph 23, and it says, as a result of the defendant's misrepresentation and omission of facts, plaintiff have sustained damages.
Yes.
Is it your position that that's not sufficient for notice of pleading? Or?
Correct, and for a couple of reasons. One, if just saying the word damage invoked a duty to defend, then there would be no sense in defining property damage specifically, bodily injury specifically, or any other kind of covered injury or damage. Because as I began my presentation, I made another point that I think is important, and that is liability policies don't just cover damage. They cover specified kinds of damages. And just saying the word damage would, if that invokes a duty to defend, an insurer in this state would have to defend literally every lawsuit that wasn't pure injunctive lawsuit.
Well, what would they have to have alleged under their theory? I know your theory is probably nothing they could have alleged would have made this complaint any good. I assume that's your theory.
They would have to have alleged physical injury to tangible property or loss of use of tangible property caused by an occurrence. And if I could return to Justice...
Say that again, please.
The definition of property damage is physical injury to tangible property or loss of use of tangible property that is caused by an occurrence when that damage arises during the policy period. That's in the insuring agreement. The record document is 70 and the page is 21. And that's the kind of damage that would invoke a duty to defend, at least at the insuring agreement level. You have to do the exclusion analysis, but that would do it at the insuring agreement level. And I'd like to return to Justice Bradley's question. She quoted paragraph 23, which follows upon paragraph 22 and is an extension of it. And I think paragraph 22 is very important and makes my point here. The allegation in paragraph 2 is plaintiffs relied upon the
representation. 2 or 22?
Pardon me?
You just said the allegations in 2. You're talking about 22.
22, I'm sorry. Plaintiffs relied upon the representations made as to the true condition of the vacant lot, and in such reliance, plaintiffs executed the offer to purchase, agreed to close the transaction, and in fact closed the transaction. That's when the damage occurred, and that's what the complaint means in the next paragraph when it says, as a result, plaintiffs sustained damages. Because they closed the transaction, they bought a lot that they're alleging they would not have bought or would only have bought at a lessened price because of a groundwater condition they did not anticipate in the purchase. And that's a far different matter from alleging, let's pick an example, that as a result of the plaintiff's misrepresentation, I suffered a crack in my foundation wall. Those cracks in the foundation wall allegations come about in the counts 5, 6, and 7 that I mentioned earlier. Those are the allegations against the home builder and the engineer. In fact, the crack in the wall isn't even alleged.
Those are allegations of what sometimes we call consequential damages. Why isn't 22 and 23 sufficient under the benefit of the bargain? Damages, you know, the difference between the value of the property as represented and its actual value at the time of purchase.
Because the consequential damage here under that theory would have been the cost of making a lot buildable for this residence as they originally planned. In other words, a lot of what's talked about in plaintiff's damages are engineering costs to put in drainage controls so that the home can actually be built there. That would be the consequential damage. Just calling a damage consequential, though, doesn't make it physical injury to tangible property. I look to Gildenband
Let me ask this. I'm looking at Wisconsin jury instructions, and the notes following Wisconsin jury instruction 2405.5 dealing with strict responsibility for damages. Addresses the benefit of the bargain, and says damages may be measured in two ways under benefit of the bargain. And the second of the two ways is the reasonable cost of placing the property received in the condition in which it was represented to be, or by omission, they thought it was represented to be. Why wouldn't that include some of the things that the purchasers are asserting?
Because the allegation of this complaint has never been that it cost or that there was a foundation wall that I cracked. That's not what's alleged here.
Counsel, would you move over to the microphone? Thank you. It's being recorded.
I have the instruction before me and the comment, and the reasonable cost of placing the property received in the condition in which it was represented to be is the reasonable cost of installing the engineering controls on the groundwater, because that's what the alleged representation was, that this was a vacant lot without groundwater problems. And so the reasonable cost of fixing that misrep is diverting the groundwater so the home can be built. Simply calling it a consequential damage does not make it physical injury to tangible property or loss of use of property. And Gildenband is a great example. That case is discussed at length in appellant's brief, and it's a case that addresses consequential damages available in a misrepresentation case. Gildenband was the sale of some unregistered cattle that the buyer thought were registered, and they were, as a result, worth less. The consequential damage the court addressed in that matter was the lost sale profit that the buyer of the cattle had sustained because he couldn't sell the unregistered cattle to a third party as registered cattle once he found out that they were unregistered. And the consequential damage defined there in Gildenband was that lost profit measure. And lost profit per se is not a physical injury to tangible property. A crack in a wall might be, but you will search in vain in this complaint to find an allegation of a crack in a wall. You have to go, actually, to the deposition of the plaintiff, which occurred almost a year and a half after the complaint was first filed in this action, to find that. And that's in the record at document 40, page 7. The appellant put this deposition transcript page into the record, and in it the plaintiff says, in answering questions about claim damage, I would like to add to that now that there's cracking inside the house that has to be taken care of also. That's a statement made in a deposition in 1996, long after the amended complaint and the complaint were ever sent to the insurance company looking for a defense in this action. If that crack in the wall invokes a duty to defend in this case, then in every case an insurer would have to track discovery and look for comments made by plaintiffs about potential physical injury to tangible property.
Are you suggesting, let me use my analogy, just the ordinary auto accident, you know, I'm a plaintiff, I got injured, and I sustained damages. Generally, that would be considered sufficient to state a cause of action for which relief can be granted. I mean, you know, it may not be flowery, but it's sufficient. But it seems to me that your position is saying, ooh, just to allege that you sustained damages isn't enough to invoke coverage under any insurance policy, that you have to specify what type of damage. And my thought is, boy, all the time you get these general notice pleadings in this state, which is very general and very notice pleading, that as a result of the negligence of the defendant who ran that stop sign, the plaintiff sustained damages. Therefore, you know, da-da-da-da-da, you get the prayer of the complaint. So are you saying that we should say in an opinion that notice pleading averring sustaining damages is not sufficient to invoke insurance coverage under a policy because it isn't particular enough? Is that what you're saying?
It depends entirely on the allegations of the complaint. In your example of a bottle or whatever injury arises out of a car accident.
It might have been just property damage.
Okay.
I didn't say.
Well, let's use the example. A car accident with notice pleading. Plaintiff says, I sustained damage. Could have been bodily injury. Could have been a purse in the front seat that was ripped open. Property damage. Could have been anything like that. But the insurer who looks at that pleading knows this is presumably it's a negligence pleading. Okay. And the insurer knows to look at that and then to go to the 1700 series in the jury instructions to find the damage instruction relevant. to find out what if I can't tell from the pleading what the damage is, I consult the law. And what would the jury instructions say is a compensable injury out of a negligence-based tort claim for a car accident? Things like bodily injury, pain and suffering, property damage. And so the insurer knows in that example, in that hypothetical, even in on an extremely bare-bones complaint, that it has a bodily injury or property damage allegation. Contrast that with the classic real estate transaction lawsuit like this one, where misrepresentation and warranty breach are alleged. The insurer, faced with a very naked pleading that says injury or damage, turns to the jury instruction. And what do they turn to? They turn to, looking for the number, 2406, the negligent misrepresentation instruction, or the strict responsibility instruction.
And if they turn there, they find that you can have consequential damages, such as loss of profits or expense of adapting the property for use with the property plaintiff had been induced to buy from the defendant. They can get travel expenses necessitated. They can also be awarded damages, other kinds of consequential damages.
Exactly my point. The policy doesn't cover consequential damages. It covers property damage defined as physical injury to tangible property. And we can look at the consequential damages cases cited to learn from that. For example, Allerman, this court well knows. A case where the buyer of property bought the property with an undisclosed well. And so the well had to be capped in order for the property to be usable as the buyer wanted it. The cost of putting the well in a closed state was a potential consequential damage. But that's not a physical injury to tangible property or a loss of use of property, just as in Gildenvand, the lost profit on the sale of the unregistered cattle was a consequential damage, but not a physical injury to tangible property.
Now, do you consider the house tangible property?
Yes.
And do you consider if there is cracking in the foundation walls, that that's physical damage to tangible property?
I think that's how a reasonable insurer would read it, yes.
Okay. So why isn't that good enough here?
Because the policy expressly says in the insuring agreement that the property damage must be caused by an occurrence, and it must be, the obligation to pay for it must be a sum that the insured would be legally obligated to pay. The insuring agreement says we will pay those sums that the insured becomes legally obligated to pay as damages. Here's where I harken back to the complaint. Remember, counts 1 through 4 are all about 1991 and misrepresentation. And that's all that's alleged against Mr. Jaffrey, not the 1993 events. And then the insuring agreement goes on to say, because of bodily injury or property damage to which this insurance applies, if caused by an occurrence, there's no occurrence for which Mr. Jaffrey is responsible in any legal sense, except for the misrepresentation responsibility that's alleged against him in counts 1 through 4.
Now, you're not willing, then, to read this complaint under paragraph 27, for example, to cover all the other things that come up in the 5th and 6th, 7th claims.
Correct, because the prayer for relief doesn't ask for joint and several liability. It says, on the first claim, judgment against defendant Jaffrey. New paragraph on the second claim. It's very specific to the allegations that preceded in the body of the complaint. And I think that's important. If you particularly look at paragraph 37 of the complaint, this is where the plaintiff alleges that the homeowner began to construct the foundation, the entire foundation hole filled up with water, and the foundation kept collapsing and collapsed 3 or 4 times. What does that tell you? Well, that the home builder has an occurrence problem because he put a home in a puddle and the foundation kept falling over. But that's not an occurrence for which Mr. Jaffrey would pay sums. That's not a misrepresentation damage. That's a negligence damage on the basis of the homeowner proceeding to build inside this huge puddle.
And I read this complaint last time we heard it, and I read it again today. And maybe it's because I just read into it that they're just setting it up in these first claims. They're doing it chronologically, and the result is that
you wind up at the end in paragraph 43 on damages, and you can put the whole thing together, but your position is you can't.
Correct. Not on the way this pleading is alleged. And I think, to use another standard, the reasonable insured wouldn't think that they had any responsibility for the home builder putting a foundation not once but four times inside the Root River, which happens to have been in the soil on this piece of property. That's not how a reasonable insurer would read the complaint in this action.
Well, what if the reasonable insured intentional? We're not dealing with intentional misrepresentation. I guess what my point is that, you know, it's not all that unreasonable if you're selling property that has water problems, that there are going to be problems with the good old water in the basement case. You know, that happens all the time. And water in the basement case, so if the reasonable insured maybe knew or should have known or was negligent in not knowing and negligent in not telling, it seems elementary that a problem with water table can cause water in the basement cases.
Could I respectfully disagree?
Okay, sure, you can even
because
not respectfully disagree.
Well, I would always respect.
Okay, thank you.
The experts in this case, and a part of the money damage claim here, and it's pecuniary damage claim, is the cost of engineering around the groundwater. And so I don't know what Mr. Jaffrey would say under oath about this, if he knew about the groundwater or not. But I think what's important is even if he knew about it, selling it would not have necessarily meant he expected problems, because he could have well expected the buyer was going to engineer around it, as buyers often do with all kinds of problems, change their grading, use a different roof material because of tree presence or any other kind of construction alteration one makes to fit the form of the land. I urge the court to look seriously at these issues and also to recognize that a decision, not that you wouldn't, but to recognize that a decision on these issues, as I have urged, would be entirely consistent with Court of Appeals decisions of this state and, in fact, decisions around the country. The Court of Appeals decisions in this state, you know, are the Benjamin case and the Qualman case. Benjamin was a case involving condos built on a landfill that settled. And the court held that misrepresentation damages are economic, not physical injury to tangible property, not covered property damage, and that this causation nexus is lacking as well, that the occurrence, the accidental misrepresentation, didn't cause the structural defects or the cracks in the wall that occurred from settling of those buildings on the landfill land. Similarly, in Qualman, the plaintiff alleged cracked basement walls, defective kitchen pipes, and the court held the same way, that this was not covered property damage and that there was no causal nexus as required by the policy between occurrence and property damage. An important thought about Benjamin and Qualman is that those decisions have been picked up, cited, and relied upon in cases throughout the country. You'll find them relied on in the cases cited in our briefs in Martin, a case from Oregon where the Court of Appeals held that negligent misrepresentation of a contaminated chicken farm was not a property damage covered by a liability policy. The Weaver case from Ohio cites Qualman and says negligent misrepresentation of residential flooding, drainage, and septic problems are not allegations covered by a liability policy.
It would be inconsistent with this Court of Appeals opinion, though. As I read the Court of Appeals opinion on page 5, it says, Jeffrey argues that West Bend is obligated to defend this action because the complaint alleges that the misrepresentation caused property damage. Absent the above exclusion, we agree. So, I mean, this Court of Appeals is saying we agree that the complaint alleges misrepresentation which caused property damage and that there is a duty to defend and indemnify. But we've got this exclusion.
I can't deny that that sentence is in the Court of Appeals decision. What I can suggest to you is that clearly the analysis that I've suggested of occurrence causing property damage was not made by the Court of Appeals. That one sentence is the only reference. And I won't call it analysis, the only reference to the issue of occurrence causing property damage. And so I urge you not to view that as a holding. In fact, it is literally, in the classic sense, dicta. It was unnecessary because they found that the exclusion applied. I see the yellow lights on, and I should probably move to that exclusion pretty quickly if I'm going to use my time judiciously.
It gives you 5 minutes.
Okay. That exclusion in the Court of Appeals decision, and I recognize we have de novo review, but I submit to you humbly that it deserves some deference. Why? Because it is the Court of Appeals, but also because it was the same analysis made by the Circuit Court. And the Court of Appeals thought well enough of the Circuit Court's analysis, Judge Jacqueline Schellinger, that it literally quoted it in its decision. So the two courts that have preceded you on this case have found this exclusion to be applicable. It's pretty clear, it's pretty simple, it's rarely litigated. It says, excludes damages to premises you sell if property damage arises from that premises. The foundation wall, if that's the property damage here, and I fervently argue it's not, but if that's property damage for which Mr. Jaffrey's liability policy would have to respond, it is excluded because it is a part of the premises, and it is a damage to the premises. The exclusion does not say that the part of the premises in existence at the time of the sale must be the part that's damaged. And that's the reading, the gloss, urged by appellant in this case. Appellant wants you to insert that language in the exclusion. It simply is not there. And I look to the material provided by appellant in the appendix and the informational bulletin on the meaning of this exclusion and why it exists, and you'll find actually that it indeed supports application of the exclusion. The article says this exclusion was intended so that no coverage for damages arising from undisclosed defects would occur. And that's the essence of the claim against Mr. Jaffrey, that this is an undisclosed defect and the damage arose from it. The case law cited, the Reeder case and the Taylor case, really are not applicable. First, the Reeder case involves bodily injury and personal property claims from tenants at an apartment building. Obviously, that's not what was alienated to them. That case is inapplicable. Taylor also inapplicable because its focus is different. It's focusing on the timing of the damage. My red light is on. I thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you. Mr. Tesmatic. We give you 15 seconds more.
Off of his time.
You got it now.
Hey, thank you. Just a few things to say in response. Number one, this argument that he started out with here, I just don't quite follow it. This court has stated over and over again, ever since we've had the discovery rule in Wisconsin, that damage occurs when the owner discovers it. The alleged misrepresentations against Mr. Jaffrey, but damages aren't manifested until over 2 years later, after they build the property and the property suffers property damage. We would not be here today if there had not been damage 2 years later to the house. If the house A never got built or B got built and nothing happened to it, we wouldn't be here. That is the property damage in the case. I'm not going to beat a dead horse here, but you know, the term damage is used in the complaint. The term damage is broad enough to encompass property damage. If it's not defined, that's broad, and the insurance company has a duty to defend. This court knows quite well, and I think the Chief Justice was leaning toward this, Wisconsin is a liberal pleadings state. The ad hominem clause, there's lots of black letter law out there. The ad hominem clause is not part of a complaint. When you're construing a complaint to see if it states a claim for relief, the ad hominem clause is not part of it. You can't utilize it in this situation either. I think that the analysis that the Chief Justice used of reading all the allegations together is the appropriate one here and the one the insurance company should be applying. As Justice Bradley pointed out, if the insurance company is going to be going to jury instructions to find out what damages might be conceivable in an ambiguous complaint, they are going to come across 2405.5 of the Wisconsin Civil Jury Instructions for Strict Responsibility, which does include the cost of repair. There was much discussion about the Four Corners test. I find that interesting because the insurance company has looked at depositions and at interrogatories and arguing as much, if not more, than I have. For example, in the last brief, the letter brief that they filed on September 28th, at page 8, further proof that the claim is not for property damage is found in discovery. And they go through and discuss all the discovery in this case. I don't want to spend all of my 5 minutes talking about the Four Corners test, but I would simply point out to the court that the Four Corners test is not quite the shield that the insurance company states it should be. This court has stated as much in Just versus Land Reclamation, a 1990 decision of this court, where the court looked at the allegations in the complaint together with the depositions, interrogatory, and affidavits. That has been picked up on by the Court of Appeals in several decisions since then, including the Montfields versus Trials case from 1998, in which the court tried to somehow come up with some harmony between the Four Corners test and what's been going on with the Supreme Court, and it basically stated that where the complaint is ambiguous, the insured must prevail if there's a doubt regarding coverage, and that would be the situation here. I would point out to the court that the Benjamin versus Dom case and the Qualman versus Bruckmoser case have no application to the facts of this case whatsoever. Just as West Bend Mutual Insurance Company wants you to ignore time on the alienated premises exclusion, they want you to ignore that regarding the Thank you.